there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. Search To Die For in your podcast app to follow the show.
Mind control. Something we most often attribute to stories of science fiction or fantasy. Usually misused by some villain hell-bent on world domination. But what if we told you that mind control was real, though maybe not in the ways you would immediately think?
There are several hair-raising examples of mind control in nature, where animals' brains are infected and controlled by parasites.
And while examples of these mind-controlling parasites are terrifying in their implications, we generally think of the human brain as too complex of a structure to control. But is it possible? Given the right conditions, could even the human brain succumb to mind control?
We know of mind-altering drugs, or alcohol, that may open the brain to a certain power of suggestion. But these are generally taken voluntarily. What would happen if your mind was altered enough that your body started doing something you could not control? And what if there was no intention behind this? Mind control without a purpose.
In the case of the Dancing Plague of 1518, when it appears by all accounts that hundreds of people fell victim to this type of anarchistic mind control, could it have been avoided? Could it have been stopped? And what exactly was it that caused people to enter this fit of dancing?
In life, there's so much we don't know. But in this podcast, we don't know for an answer. Every week, we investigate the greatest mysteries of history and life on Earth.
Welcome to Unexplained Mysteries. I'm your host, Richard.
And I'm your host, Claire. This is our final episode on the Dancing Plague of 1518, where we will try our best to uncover the almost mystical epidemic that struck the city of Strasbourg in 1518.
If you like the show, you can subscribe on your favorite podcast directory. A new episode comes out every Thursday. And while you're there, we'd greatly appreciate a 5-star review. It seems simple, but it really helps our show.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, on Twitter at Parcast Network, and at Parcast.com.
Last week, we covered the events and details of the Dancing Plague of 1518, how one woman began dancing on the streets of Strasbourg, Alsace, in the Holy Roman Empire. Within a month of her hysterical and trance-like dance, hundreds of people had joined in until they collapsed from exhaustion or died.
Upper estimates have the dancing plague killing hundreds of people, while the lower estimates suggest about a dozen. Whatever the number, the plague was a powerful and strange epidemic that left the city of Strasbourg shocked and flabbergasted for some time to come.
The main chronicler of the Dancing Plague of 1518 was a man named Paracelsus. He quickly became enamored with the mysteries surrounding the Dancing Plague and coined it chorea lasciva, which we now term choreomania or dancing mania. In order to study choreomania thoroughly, we need to recap some of the strangest and most unexplainable things about the dancing plague.
Number one, how did the plague spread so fast? Chroniclers in Strasbourg claimed that the citizens would succumb to the dancing plague merely by looking upon it. Was it something in the air that opened them to this type of suggestion? Something they ate? Or was the appeal of dancing off their troubles just too great to resist?
Number two, why were the dancers so completely fixated on dancing? The dancers of Strasbourg could not be bothered to speak, eat, or drink. City workers had to force them to take sips of water, and they refused to stop dancing unless they collapsed from sheer exhaustion.
Number three, why was it mostly women and peasants that succumbed to the plague?
And finally, number four, how was it possible that these dancers exerted so much effort? As we mentioned in the last episode, historian John Waller likened dancing for days at a time to running a marathon. We might assume these were peasants and workers hardened by physical labor and the conditions of the time, but we must remember they were mostly malnourished and weakened by starvation, disease, and drought. So how is it possible for these people to exhibit a physical feat most of us would have to train months for today?
The main theories trying to explain the dancing plague come from trying to answer each of these questions. The first theory is an organic one. It suggests that a peculiar type of fungus might have infected the food chain in Strasbourg. A fungus powerful enough to cause people to hallucinate and therefore begin their erratic dance.
Our second theory involves a similar type of dance in a southern region of Italy. There, people performed a dancing ritual to try and rid themselves of toxins. Is it possible that the dancing plague in Strasbourg had a similar superstitious origin?
Our third and final theory says that the dancing plague was a type of mass psychotic break. The stress and hardships of the time were great enough that it ultimately snapped the minds of Strasbourg citizens. This led them to enter a trance-like state where they danced as though completely possessed.
The important link between these theories and a question we will continue to return to is a question of intention. Was their dancing based on a decision, or was it out of their own control? Were they even possibly under a form of mind control?
Since the 1960s, hallucinogenic drugs have become a staple of counterculture and a fundamental part of our history. And whether or not you agree with their legality and use, their impact is hard to deny.
Hallucinogenic drug use is often associated with clubs, raves, and dancing. This makes you wonder if hallucinogens played a role in the dancing plague of 1518. Would it be possible the dancers' behavior resulted from accidentally ingesting a mind-altering drug?
One major theory behind the dancing plague of 1518 is that that very thing happened, that a type of fungus made its way into the food system, and the unknown ingestion of the drug by hundreds of people was the spark that caused many people to start to dance. The fungus specifically was called ergot. Accidentally ingesting too much of it had some less than desirable effects.
Ergot poisoning was the result of too much dampness settling on rye and other crops that were most readily available to peasants. Therefore, after a particularly damp year, it was possible that this poisoning could affect a large swath of people.
Recall from our last episode that the years leading up to 1518 were laden with drought. Harsh weather like hailstorms and intense late freezes cut down on harvests. It is therefore very possible that some crops normally deemed unsuitable would slip through the cracks and make it to circulation.
Symptoms of ergot poisoning included random convulsions and loss of bodily control, irrational behavior, and hallucinations.
Being poisoned with ergot was to be afflicted with what physicians dubbed St. Anthony's fire. Poisoning from the fungus was common enough that there was a hospital in the 11th century founded solely for the purpose of treating it. The hospital was called Hospital Brothers of St. Anthony, and thereby spawned the name St. Anthony's Fire.
On the surface, it sounds like St. Anthony's Fire is a good catalyst for the dancing mania that overran Strasbourg.
The dancers obviously displayed similar symptoms: hallucinations, convulsive movements, the inability to think clearly.
However, if we look closer, the candidate loses favor. Ergot does not account for the physical demands of the dance and hallucinations. It also seems unlikely that hundreds of people would react in the exact same way to ergot poisoning when the symptoms of St. Anthony's fire were known to be much more varied. For example, ergot poisoning symptoms included burning sensation in the limbs, the onset of gangrene, and such a severe lack of blood flow to arms and legs that could result in the loss of limbs. If the dancing plague victims were poisoned by ergot fungus, the restricted blood flow would probably make the obsessive dancing very difficult.
It's also worth noting that ergot poisoning was a fairly well-known disease, and physicians would have recognized and treated the symptoms. Flour mills also took strong precautions to avoid ergot poisoning, so it seems unlikely that such a powerful outbreak would slip through the cracks.
We think that while the ergot poisoning theory answers some of the mysteries of the dancing plague, it is not strong enough to cover some of the most important riddles. Ergot could cause maniacal dancing, but wouldn't sustain that dance for days on end.
So we feel pretty comfortable ruling this theory out.
Perhaps it was not a hallucination, but was it intentional? Did the dancers decide to dance, or was it a product of something they could not control? Was there something in the beliefs or superstitions of the people of Strasbourg that made them start dancing?
Put more simply, was there anything that could have made them want to participate in this hysterical dance?
Our second theory involves another dancing epidemic. One that has enough similarities to the dancing plague that comparing the two might just reveal some key truths to the 1518 plague that struck Strasbourg.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network. Now the story continues.
As we discussed last episode, the dancing plague of 1518 was not an isolated incident. A little further south in Europe, there was a similar type of hysterical dance performed. But by all accounts, this dance had a very strange and very specific purpose.
In southern Italy, between the 16th and 17th century, it was a common practice for groups of people to participate in a type of frenzied dance.
Participants would become immensely excitable. They would cry out, dance, tremble, and laugh in a hysterical fashion. The dance was thought to rid the body of the toxins from the bite of a wolf spider or the sting of a scorpion. The dancing affliction was given a name, tarantism, after the species of tarantula it was associated with.
Others who witnessed another in a fit of tarantism would often join in.
Although the origins of tarantism are murky, its similarities with the dancing plague are hard to deny. Tarantism was assumed to come from spider bites, though whether the dancing participants were doing so because of toxic effects or they believed it to be an actual cure is unclear.
What is clear is that even if they made the decision to dance, they entered a similar hysterical state where often the only thing to stop them from dancing was sheer exhaustion.
It is said that tarantism happened only during the summer months, and if one person began to dance, others would join because they believed that the heat reactivated the venom from past bites.
However, some believe that Tarantism was a covert way to celebrate a cultural tradition. In 186 BC, the Roman Senate banned what are known as the Bacchanalian rites. These rites stemmed from the cult of Bacchus. Participants would engage in increasingly maniacal dancing in an attempt to commune with higher spirits.
Historians propose that Tarantism was a disguised attempt to perform these rites. Because they masked it as an affliction from a spider bite, they were able to perform an age-old tradition without breaking the current laws.
And though the evidence is thin on whether Tarantism was the celebration of a pagan cult or an actual reaction to a spider bite, it does highlight something very important.
It shows that the frenzied dance of Tarantism had a voluntary nature to it. People joined the dance by choice, and they did so because of what they believed in.
However, when dancers participated, they lost themselves to the same sort of hysterics written about during the dancing plague of 1518. That is, once they started, it was difficult for them to stop.
The similarities are uncanny. The participants in Tarantism were peasants, women more often than men, and under great strain from the weights of life. The symptoms of the afflicted were similar as well. Unrelenting dancing until collapse from exhaustion or death, twitching, visions, and trembling. However, the more voluntary nature of Tarantism makes the dancing plague of 1518 all the more peculiar, as the dancing plague appears to not have its roots in any specific ritual.
With Tarantism, there seemed to be a particular purpose or reason for their dance. There was a genuine belief that this activity could heal, or alternatively, it was rooted in a centuries-old pagan ritual. The dancing plague of 1518 had no such belief. Participants were acting like they were under some great spell, unable to make decisions on their own.
But the similarities between the two epidemics are important. It suggests that perhaps the heat, the strain of life, and the constant state of fear are catalysts for this type of hysteria. Was there something about the difficulties and pain of 16th century Europe that initiated this frenzied behavior?
And if there was, why did those conditions cause those hysterical people to dance, of all things?
The answer to these questions is troubling enough that it forces us to look at the fundamental nature of the human consciousness and confront its greatest vulnerabilities. Choreomania, or dancing mania, is officially classified as a mass psychogenic illness, or an illness that affects a group of people through a nervous system disturbance with no organic cause.
The key phrase there is no organic cause. That means that the dancing plague of 1518 officially did not stem from a fungus, a dietary problem, or any particular virus or physical ailment. It appears that the cause of the 1518 dancing plague was almost entirely mental.
And this once again returns us to the question of intentionality. Did the participants decide to dance or not?
By its official classification, the answer to that question is no. The theory is that everything the dancers suffered was completely involuntary.
This is incredible to think about. Most diseases and plagues we can understand as biological processes. A virus transfers through one form of physical process or another, and the newly infected host must deal with the consequences. But is it possible for affliction to pass by sight alone? Is it really possible that this was a case of sudden and spontaneous hypnosis? Can such a thing really exist?
In the case of the dancing plague, the answer is yes. Those who joined only had to glance upon a crowd of dancing mania to succumb to its temptation. They were, for lack of a better word, hypnotized on the spot, fixed into a mental state they could not escape.
To understand this type of hypnosis, it's beneficial for us to look into the long history of trance and hypnosis, both induced and involuntary, to help us better understand what happened to each individual that was pulled into the dancing fray. Though hypnosis is a method and trance is a result, for the purposes of this discussion, we will consider them synonymous.
When people talk about trance and hypnosis, you might think of it as some type of mystic gibberish, a gimmick used by a con artist to gain money and influence. However, trance and various states of trance are both very real and play an important role in our history.
The state of trance continues to be an elusive and ill-defined mental state. Over the years, all cultures have tried to induce trance with music, drugs, dancing, and a host of other practices. A very important piece of bringing about a trance state is suggestibility. One has to be open to entering a trance state in order for it to work.
And trance states are not only limited to possession or shamanistic rituals. You can reach a trance state by something as simple as meditating in a yoga class.
On a scientific level, a trance state is an obstruction of serotonin in the brain, which changes the mind's relationship with reality.
Trance-inducing rituals have played an important role in almost all modern cultures and religions. And though the definition is immensely complex, we know two fundamental and important things about trance. Number one, that it leads to an altered state of consciousness or an awareness of reality that is fundamentally different than our default waking state.
And number two, that it physically changes the brain. That is, neurotransmitters in the brain are clogged in certain areas, preventing a full range of functionality.
In particular, going into a trance clogs the left hemisphere, the one responsible for rational thought, and leaves the right hemisphere, the side responsible for creativity and imagination, free and in control.
This is why dancing and trance are so often related. It's often believed that rhythmic movement and appeasement of the right hemisphere maintains the state of trance for longer, which perhaps is how our dancers stayed under the influence of the trance for so long.
Though that might be getting a little ahead of ourselves.
And while there are countless examples of spontaneous trance and trance-inducing rituals, we find it more practical to look at these together and then to catalog them individually. First, a very important prerequisite for inducing trance is openness. Without being vulnerable to suggestion, it is likely that the brain will simply shut out reality-shifting possibilities.
Anthropologist Erica Bourguignon calls this an environment of belief, a place where the conditions are met such that people believe that trance, possession, and altered states could happen at any time. That is, if you have encountered somebody who you believed was possessed, you might then consider the possibility more seriously and be more open to it happening to you.
Trance also almost always seems to abide by cultural beliefs. That is, even in a state of subdued consciousness, the mind will remain faithful to the appropriate cultural practices and will act out the altered state of consciousness according to expectations of what trance means to one's specific beliefs.
In the case of those suffering from Tarantism in southern Italy, they often bent backwards and walked on their hands and heels to imitate the look of the spider. Those who practice Haitian voodoo rituals will act out the roles of the deities that are supposedly possessing them.
The response to a state of trance is not universal. And though possession and trance rituals are practiced worldwide, the enactment of them happens according to people's beliefs.
This emphasizes the importance of suggestion and expectation in terms of trance. Those who are expecting to go into a trance are the most likely to be infected and they will act in a way that is according to what they have learned and consistent with their culture.
Which means that a part of the brain is still operating. And though that part might be deep-rooted in our subconscious, it still is present enough to have some sort of influence on an individual's behavior.
In 1518 Strasbourg, divine ritual, possession, trance, and exorcism were all a fundamental part of society. As we described last episode, this was a mystical and violent world where any type of abnormality was likely prescribed to God, the devil, or any host of displeased demons or saints.
Because commoners of Strasbourg lived in a very spiritual, very religious world that often succumbed to great tragedy, they were almost always prepared for some type of metaphysical intervention.
In this case, the possession of a woman that forced her to dance.
And so, maybe when people saw this possessed woman, their openness and willingness to suggestion drew them in one by one. And as the numbers grew, the powers of suggestion grew.
If so many people were possessed, won't I be possessed as well?
And like a wildfire, the trance state would spread, claiming victims who were constantly in fear of the divine, and more importantly, willing to believe that they are just as vulnerable as the next person.
This is backed up by the fact that once authorities attributed the dancing plague to St. Vitus, the numbers started to multiply. All it took was the face of an angry saint for people to believe in its possibilities. Peasants completely at the mercy of a corrupt clergy were not in the position to doubt authorities when they claimed God's wrath.
And to believe in that wrath was to be subject to it, to be condemned to dance to exhaustion or death.
The trance hypothesis helps to answer a lot of questions about the dancing plague of 1518. The minds of the victims were fundamentally altered, and their states of consciousness were changed enough that we could consider them on an entirely different plane of existence. Their basic decision-making was hindered because the rational side of their brain was blocked. They seemed hypnotized because, in a way, they were hypnotized.
It also explains the intensity of the dance. It's believed that rhythmic motion can heighten the intensity of a trance state. So combined with the subdued state of their rational hemisphere, the victims were stuck in a vicious and unstoppable cycle.
Lastly, it highlights how important the power of suggestion was and how serious of a role belief played in the dancing plague. Because this happened in a downtrodden society that fundamentally believed they deserved to be punished in one form or another, they gave in to the suggestion with much greater ease than one would expect from a more prosperous society.
This is why the cure worked. Hauling the dancing victims to the St. Vitus shrine succeeded because the people believed it would succeed.
It was not the ritual they undertook at the shrine, nor was it because a saint was finally appeased. It worked because the peasants believed in it. The power of suggestion was both the solution and the problem.
However, what it doesn't tell us is why it started. What made Frau Trofea step out onto the street and begin to dance? If we go back to our assumption that there was no organic cause, nothing physical or internal that occurred in our patient zero, what was it externally that caused this outbreak to start?
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message. And now let's continue the story.
The living conditions of Strasbourg in 1518 were horrendous, to say the least. As we touched on last episode, the relationship between the clergy, the peasants, and the oligarchs was strained to the point of collapse.
The clergy continually took advantage of their position as the literate class to claim the peasants owed them penance and sin taxes if they wanted a shot at making it to paradise. With this income, priests indulged in expensive luxuries. The Holy Roman Empire was facing a crisis between the clergy and peasants as priests and nuns constantly manipulated their power for personal gain.
However, when the dancing plague broke out, the bizarre nature of it led many to believe it was religious in nature.
Many assumed the plague was brought upon by Saint Vitus, a saint that many celebrated by dancing. Citizens believed that perhaps they were not worshiping the saint enough, and the dancing was his revenge.
The worshiping of saints was a regular part of medieval life, and each saint played a particular role in the lives of European citizens.
If a saint was troubled by the lack of respects paid, they would punish the citizens. In the case of the dancing plague, Saint Vitus was demanding that people spend more time dancing for him.
This was supported by the fact that the plague only subsided as authorities began to haul the dancers to a shrine for Saint Vitus on a mountain outside of town. This probably only helped to dissipate the plague, as it removed dancers from proximity to each other.
But in a time when saints and demons were a part of the everyday life, when worship was as important as daily meals, and all citizens feared the wrath of God, they still found the dancing plague extraordinary and frightening.
Though the plague affected both sexes, most dancers were women, and the extremely misogynistic society of the time was quick to point this out. Women were assumed to have an insatiably lustful nature, and their minds were manifestations of sin itself. So naturally, the plague must be a result of the devil infecting these vulnerabilities. In fact, Paracelsus, one of the main chroniclers of the dancing plague, called the victims, quote, free, lewd, and impertinent, full of lasciviousness and without fear or respect, end quote. He even went so far as to call them whores and scoundrels, highlighting the lack of sympathy for those who suffered from the dance, as the academics of the time assumed it was deserved and brought on by sin.
Though it is because of the mistreatment of women that caused the dancers to be mostly women and not the other way around. Maltreatment and suffering were very much correlated with the onset of the dancing plague.
And that's what makes this whole thing so strange and fascinating. There is a contrast between suffering and dancing that we cannot avoid.
This was the world Frau Trofea danced into, a region with vast economic divide, starvation, and disease. A world where peasants were constantly on the brink of a breaking point.
We know that malnourishment and poor living conditions can affect brain operation. Diets low in mineral content will prevent the proper production of serotonin, a compound in our brains fundamental in regulating our behavior. This suggests that although the trance state was heavily influenced by external factors, there were some biological factors at play as well.
Combine this with lowered serotonin production from high stress levels and the likelihood that most of the peasant population was constantly living in a type of altered state, we might hypothesize that the peasants of Strasbourg were always on the brink of mental collapse.
Because of the terrible diet of the peasant population and an imbalanced production of serotonin, the likelihood of entering a trance state significantly increased. And if we look at the other outbreaks of dancing plagues in European history, they all came at the tail end of severe and widespread psychological stress.
For example, the dancing plague in 1374 came only months after a massive flood devastated the European valleys of the Rhine and Moselle. The flood poured over the walls of cities and drowned homes, causing much death.
It was in the wake of devastation when dancing plague struck. They all happened to the poorest of citizens under the worst of conditions. The human psyche has shown that when pushed to the brink, it will eventually give way. And when it does, it manifests in the strangest and most unpredictable ways. In medieval times, the woman was considered significantly inferior to her male counterpart. Priests hammered home the role of Eve as the harbinger of evil in the Bible, and society had a long-standing and deep-rooted mistrust of women.
It was an expectation for husbands to beat their wives mercilessly. Women were not only the subject to these beatings, but several other repeated atrocities. Sexual violence and adultery were commonplace, and whenever society erred, the finger-pointing immediately went to women first. Even in the case of the Dancing Plague, it was first assumed that the women participants earned the treachery brought upon them.
And this was a life women could not escape. The society of the Renaissance was not structured in such a way that they had any way to escape their fate. Freedoms for women were extremely limited, and we can imagine the incredible amount of suffering they endured day after day.
Therefore, Frau Trofea, a woman most likely hungry, abused, and at her wit's end, stepped out in a trance and began to dance.
If we are to believe historian John Waller, the authority on the Dancing Plague of 1518, this breaking point came as a result of these terrible conditions. He claims that Frau Trofea's act of dancing was not one of rebellion against the suffering she faced day after day, but more of a psychotic break. The moment when her mind could no longer handle the terrible conditions life had laid out for her.
And if we believe this, we understand why more women than men fell into the fits of the Dancing Plague. High stress levels lower the production of serotonin. Therefore, Frau Trofea's stress-inducing circumstances would make her more open to a trance state. That is what makes the Dancing Plague of 1518 so fascinating, that there was not one single catalyst or infection that brought it about. No, our theory is that the Dancing Plague was the result of a myriad of troubles plaguing a region and the religious beliefs that ran that region.
The extreme poverty, the starvation, the unpredictable and unfortunate weather, the unnecessary greed of the clergy, the debasement of women, the heat of the summer, and the belief in the curses of saints. These were all factors that built to the breaking point. All the ingredients needed for the recipe to make hundreds of people dance to their deaths. All it took was one woman and a lot of suggestion to spark an epidemic the likes of which we have not seen since.
And although we have seen states of trance, voluntary and spontaneous alike, appear throughout history, the random occurrence of dancing plagues soon faded away. The most logical explanation is that as living conditions slowly improved over the last several centuries, humanity's minds were less and less likely to be pushed to the point of hysteria.
We will probably never know what was really happening in the minds of the citizens that succumbed to the dancing plague. We will never know why they danced instead of jumping or singing or shouting. We will never know the details of each of the citizens' lives, whether they recovered, and what became of their children.
But what we do know is that the Dancing Plague was a real and frightful epidemic. It called into question the practices of the clergy and for a moment took a city on the brink of revolution and brought them together to find a solution.
Though ultimately things would return to normal, revolution was indeed at hand. A peasant rebellion would soon reshape the entirety of the Holy Roman Empire, and a great fight for the rights of the common man would sweep Europe.
The Dancing Plague of 1518 is a reminder of the limits of the human mind, that with enough stress and strain, it can be broken. And if anything, the Dancing Plague symbolizes that we are not always in control and that the mystery of our minds may remain unsolved for quite some time.
To Don't forget to subscribe to Unexplained Mysteries on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other podcast directory. If you like what you hear, leave a 5-star review or tell us what you think on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and Twitter @ParcastNetwork. It seems simple, but it really helps our show.
A new episode comes out every Thursday.
And remember, never take "we don't know" for an answer.
Unexplained Mysteries was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Unexplained Mysteries is written by Drew Cole and stars Claire Delamar and Richard Rossner.